Hello. On this week's program, an exhibition at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts highlights some of its most notable recent acquisitions. We speak with curator Robert Cossolino. Jason Pfeiffer takes a look at the legacy of playwright August Wilson, whose Pulitzer Prize-winning show The Piano Lesson is now at the Arden Theatre in Philadelphia. Susan Lewis looks at Pennsylvania Ballet's latest production, which is based on Handel's Messiah. And we speak with the Kimmel Center's Mervon Mehta on what he's got programmed for the center's 08-09 season. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
An exhibition now at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts showcases emerging artists. Spot Check Academy Contemporary highlights over a dozen works purchased with the Academy's Contemporary Art Development Fund. This dedicated fund was started in 2004 to ensure that the Academy's permanent collection continues to amass new works by promising young contemporary visual artists. I met with PAFA's curator of modern art, Robert Cossolino, earlier this week to ask him what guided his purchasing decisions for many of the works in this show.
Our Museum Committee for Collections agreed that part of the acquisition strategy should take into account that the Academy wants to support emerging artists, artists who may have had their work in some significant group exhibitions, maybe have had a solo show here or there, but for the most part are people who show significant talent and promise, who are gaining a reputation, and yet are still affordable and haven't quite gotten either out of Philadelphia or the particular cities that they work in. So they're on the cusp of being discovered by the wider world. And so it's an inherently risk-taking strategy, but it's one that I think is very important for a museum like the Pennsylvania Academy that's also tied to a school and thinks about the future of art. So the Contemporary Art Development Fund was set aside to buy emerging artists when their prices are relatively low, when we're sort of betting on them as curators and hoping that their reputations are going to rise. And in some instances, really over just 3 years, some of these artists have gone on for a lot greater recognition than they had when we purchased them. So already we're seeing that some of our choices are turning out to be pretty exciting.
And is there kind of a that's it moment when you stand in front of a painting or a sculpture that you know that that's the one for here?
That's one of the most exciting parts of your job as a curator, is meeting artists and also going to see exhibitions and discovering new people, finding a work of art in a gallery that grabs you and pulls you in. I'll just use one as an example, Astrid Bowlby's work. Astrid is an installation artist, a printmaker, and also makes drawings. And she shows at Gallery Joe in Philadelphia. And I bought 3 drawings that they're now currently on view. And when I saw Astrid's work, I just couldn't get enough of it. And it has this organic quality. It's ritualistic in terms of how it's made. And it's something that resists easy interpretation and yet is not impenetrable. So you can keep seeing more and more in the work.
Why is there such a dearth of opportunities for emerging artists to show in mainstream museums and galleries?
Local artists often think that the big encyclopedic museums have other priorities besides supporting their own. One thing that the Pennsylvania Academy has gone out of their way to do, at least since I've been here, is really go out into the community, meet and talk to the artists that show at 1026, all the DIY galleries, as well as the big commercial spaces like Locks. Look at those exhibitions, think about whether the work would fit into our collection, and really take risks. Go on that gut reaction that it's a work of art that really grabs you, and really support local people, not because they're local, and you should, but because the quality of their work is just as good as the stuff being done in New York. Maybe there just isn't as much PR being given to them. I think the Pennsylvania Academy, since it is a national collection of American art, has an obligation and a unique position to find the very best Philadelphia art and show it here first.
Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts curator of modern art, Robert Cossolino. Spot Check Academy Contemporary runs through June 8th.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Among the most notable American playwrights of the 20th century was Pennsylvania native August Wilson. He died of cancer 2 years ago, but not before completing a widely celebrated cycle of 10 plays, 2 of which won Pulitzer Prizes for drama. In 2005, Philadelphia's Arden Theatre staged Fences, and as WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, this week the Arden opens the second prize winner, with a director who knew the playwright and his work very well.
Walter Dallas, director of the Arden's latest production, The Piano Lesson, recalls when he first met August Wilson in Philadelphia back in the 80s at a performance of a Wilson play.
For some reason, I was late getting back from intermission, and as I was coming in down the steps going toward the theater, there was this guy sitting on the steps, and I said, "Oh, are you going back in? Were you seeing the play?" And he says, "Well, I've seen it a couple of times. I wrote it."
Striking up a conversation, the two missed much of the play's second act, but in doing so began a friendship. The longtime artistic director of the Freedom Theater in Philadelphia, Dallas went on to direct the world premiere of Wilson's Seven Guitars. And with the Arden's production of The Piano Lesson, Dallas is now directing his fifth Wilson play. With each August Wilson play that he's either directed or just watched, Dallas says there's a common element of telling and celebrating the American story through the lens of the African-American experience.
And he didn't try to talk about the entire African-American experience. They were all very specific plays about specific situations. But in those plays, he captured the essence of what the struggle was, what the joys were, what the tribulations were.
Dallas says Wilson's 10-play cycle, a decade-by-decade chronicle of 20th-century African-American life, captures an important part of this country's history from the last century in a way that had not been done before in theater. According to Terry Nolan, artistic director of the Arden Theater, the scope of the anthology, which is set almost entirely in Wilson's hometown, Pittsburgh, is reason enough to consider Wilson a great playwright.
It's almost an unparalleled accomplishment.
But Nolan says Wilson's legacy is also linked to writing truly compelling plays about American families, like The Piano Lesson, which Nolan selected for the Arden's 20th season.
This has always been one of my favorite plays, so when we were trying to put together this anniversary season and thinking about stories that deal with the American family, this play leapt to my mind.
The Piano Lesson is centered on a family piano covered with beautiful African-style carvings. Brother and sister, Boy Willie and Bernice, battle over what to do with the treasured family heirloom that was carved by their great-grandfather, a plantation carpenter slave.
I don't care what Bernice say. I'm selling my half. It ain't my fault her half got to go along with it. Ain't like I'm trying to cheat her out of her half. Come on, Lonnie.
Boy Willie, a Mississippi sharecropper played here by Kes Kehemnu, wants to sell the piano so that he can buy land and build a better future. Bernice, on the other hand, who lives in Pittsburgh, wants to keep the piano as a way of remembering and honoring the family's past. Toby Zinman, who's had the chance to see all 10 plays in Wilson's so-called Pittsburgh cycle, is a University of the Arts English professor and Philadelphia Inquirer theater critic. Zinman says that in The Piano Lesson and all his plays, Wilson has a knack for florid prose.
Partly what he can do is get the rhythms of natural speech and invest them with a kind of music, a kind of poetry, a kind of power that gives these people a kind of grandeur, even though they're not talking about anything so grand.
Zinman says that especially in the earlier plays of the cycle, the African roots of Black America and its slave history are given considerable attention. She observes that Wilson was deeply concerned with how the heritage of African Americans is remembered.
One of the things August Wilson said was, if you don't connect with the past, you don't know who you are in the present. You may prove to be unworthy of the past. And this is a play that I think is really a debate about how you deal with the past.
The debate isn't a simple one. The Piano Lesson is set in 1936, a time that Walter Dallas says was a turning point in the century for many African Americans who were trying to break free from the after effects of slavery and a cycle of poverty.
Many people who had, of course, come out of slavery were still sharecropping. They were no longer slaves, but they were still working the same land. And we know that the sharecropping system was not favorable to the people who were doing the work. By the time they paid for their food and their housing and their clothing and their medical, et cetera, they probably owed money at the end of the work cycle and had to go back to work.
With this in mind, Dallas says Boy Willie's desire to make a clean break from the past and sell the piano in exchange for a more hopeful future is understandable. But Bernice's argument is also strong, that the pride and pain of the past represented by the piano is far too valuable to sell. The importance of the past is underscored by the mystical elements of The Piano Lesson. Dallas explains that while the realism of the characters in the play and the 1930s Pittsburgh setting is striking, there's also a very mythical quality to the piece. It includes ghosts, whose tragic stories are intertwined with the family heirloom.
In some sense, one might simply reduce the pianist and say it's a ghost story. It's about a house that's haunted because there's a piano that has a history in that house. As we follow the trail of this piano, we follow the lives of the people who were on this plantation and how the movement of this piano from one place to the next affected people and how that piano now, in 1936, remains as a legacy.
It's only been a little over 2 years since August Wilson's death. Yet the piano lesson and the Pittsburgh cycle, with its expansive exploration of the African-American experience, call attention to Wilson's remarkable legacy. The Art and Theater's Terry Nolan says though his company is now embarking on just its second Wilson production,
I know we're going to do a lot more.
With a full cycle of plays to draw from, there's plenty more to do.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. August Wilson's The Piano Lesson is now at the Arden Theater. It runs through April 6th. Although American audiences are more accustomed to hearing Handel's Messiah during the Christmas season, the oratorio was originally composed for a concert at this time of year. And while Messiah is usually a listening experience, a production at Pennsylvania Ballet adds visuals with costumes, sets, and of course, dancers. Handel never set this music to dance, but WRTI's Susan Lewis finds that this ballet is in many ways in keeping with the spirit of the 18th century composer.
The first performance of Messiah was on April 13, 1742, on Fishamble Street in Dublin. German-born George Frederick Handel was by then a successful opera composer living in England. Two reasons compelled him to write Messiah as an oratorio, a dramatic choral work performed with orchestra based on biblical text. One, English tastes for opera were waning, and two, he was commissioned to create a concert during the Christian observance of Lent, when theatrical performances, like opera, were banned. Fast forward some 250 years plus to 1999. Former artistic director of Pennsylvania Ballet, choreographer Robert Weiss, was putting together his first Christmas season of the Carolina Ballet in Raleigh, North Carolina. Weiss seized the moment to create Messiah as a ballet for two reasons of his own. The Nutcracker, the perennial favorite, had already been scheduled by another company, and the music of Messiah had captivated Weiss since he'd first heard it at a concert as a young boy and wanted to dance in the aisle.
And the music always struck me as something that could, you could tell the story and you could also dance to it, and the joyous parts would just be so bouncy and joyous, and the sad, angst-ridden parts, I mean, it's very theatrical, even though it's an oratorio.
The oratorio does tell a story. Although Handel's librettist, Charles Jennens, fashioned it not from an intact biblical text, as was typical, but from assorted biblical references from various works of the Bible. To this libretto, Handel wrote notes that in some places musically describe the words. Elizabeth Braden, director of Philadelphia Cantori, the singers in this Pennsylvania Ballet production, points to one example of this text painting.
The piece called All We Like Sheep Have Gone Astray. And always on the word have gone astray, the voice parts stray from the line. They go stray up or down, and sometimes two at the same time will go in opposite directions. So it really gives the illusion of this has gone astray.
Descriptive sacred text and commanding music. When Robert Weiss suggested adding dance, he faced some resistance.
Number one, it's too holy a piece. You're going to do something that's going to offend somebody. The music is so complete. What are you going to add to it? You're only going to take something away from it by having a visual. And I said, you know, look, maybe it will fail, but I want to try. I said, this is just something I've always wanted to do, and I'm going to do it, and we'll see what happens.
What happened, says Weiss, was that Messiah became Carolina's biggest success. The dancers act out a tale within a tale. The story of the Messiah within the story of a congregation celebrating the Messiah. In part one, the cavernous dark space of a church is suggested. Shafts of light shine on assembled worshipers. Part two goes back to biblical times with costumed dancers telling the story of the Passion. And part three, the aftermath, is a ballet in white, symbolizing purity, harmony, and balance. Some sections are literal. Other sections are more abstract. And some parts continue to evolve.
I make little changes every time because, you know, I'm still alive and I see things and I go, well, that could be better.
In this particular production, for example, Weiss has changed the scene to the music All We Like Sheep.
I originally had real sheep, you know, dancers playing sheep, little sheep heads and little sheep tails, and it was very cute. But a lot of people said to me, you know, it's corny. So I tried to do something a little bit more, not as literal, but figurative, and going astray, people drinking, people switching partners, sinning.
The order of the music, for the most part, follows the oratorio. In one notable exception, Weiss moved the Hallelujah Chorus to the end of Part 1. And no, it's not expected that the audience should stand, as has been traditional with the oratorio ever since King George reportedly stood up during that movement in 1743. In Philadelphia, Pennsylvania Ballet artistic director Roy Kaiser was drawn to Weiss's Messiah because of the way the dance and the music enrich one another. The dance, with costumes and dramatic lighting, adds a striking visual experience. The music is rich with possibilities.
The different textures that are woven throughout the score, it lends itself to so many different types of movement.
While much of the ballet is on point, there's a pas de deux danced barefoot. Weiss resists classifying his choreography as strictly one style or another. He starts with a classical idiom and then incorporates everything he knows. He describes ballet as the great gobbler of all other dance forms.
Ballet actually takes everything and makes it more classical and incorporates it in some way.
While the dancers learn the music and movement, the singers learn the music and text. Choral conductor Elizabeth Braden says in a dance performance, singers must be able to sing quickly and clearly, to be both precise and flexible with tempo. Messiah, in particular, has a lot of fast-moving runs.
And there were some that we practiced very fast, medium fast, and a little slower than fast, so that we would be ready for whatever is determined, because a lot of it happens so last minute, till they actually get on the stage.
Putting it all together is the final feat. In this production, the orchestra and chorus are in the pit, voice soloists mostly in the proscenium box, and dancers on the stage, all led by one conductor. Roy Kaiser says, in general, this is why ballet conductors like Pennsylvania Ballet's Beatrice Afrin are such special musicians.
She has the fate of every dancer on stage in her hands every night, and when there's a time for a conductor to ease up a little bit on a tempo for a certain sequence of movement, maybe, but there's also a time that the conductor needs to push and really, really drive the dancer.
For her part, Afrin says, although she leads the performance, the ballet can evolve. Tempos worked out in advance with a piano in a rehearsal hall may change a bit when orchestra, chorus, and dancers join forces. In each performance,
they respond to what they're doing or they'll respond to what I'm doing, and, you know, we sometimes discuss in between shows.
And Afrin says Handel himself adapted his oratorio to the artists who would perform it.
He performed it differently every year in the sense that he would perform certain numbers and not others. He would change the order of things, perform things in different keys based on the comfort level of the singers. It was a very fluid idea, I think, about a work of art.
In the end, the ballet Messiah provides another way to experience dance with glorious music and colorful text, and to contemplate what Robert Weiss hopes is a universal message.
You don't need to have any religion to feel a sense of spirituality and connectedness to everyone else in the world. We're all striving to be better than we necessarily are, and I think that's what the piece is about.
Choreographer Robert Weiss, ending that report by WRTI's Susan Lewis. The last three Pennsylvania Ballet performances of Weiss's Messiah are at the Academy of Music in Philadelphia this afternoon, this evening, and tomorrow afternoon. The Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts this week announced details of its forthcoming season. The roster of dance, world music, jazz, and classical music presentations features artists from 20 different countries in about 60 performances in 9 series. Among these will be recitals by established artists like Itzhak Perlman, Daniel Barenboim, and Hilary Hahn. Among the strong jazz offerings are performances by Cassandra Wilson and the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra led by Wynton Marsalis. In world music, sitarist composer Ravi Shankar returns for a special performance with his daughter Anushka, and the Philadelphia-born dancer and choreographer Rene Harris brings his company to the center for 3 nights. The Great Orchestras Tour series will feature visits by the New York Philharmonic, the Cleveland Orchestra, the Vienna Philharmonic, and the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by the Venezuelan conducting sensation Gustavo Dudamel. WRTI will broadcast the new music series Fresh Ink and the Jazz Up Close performances, which will this year celebrate the 50th anniversary of Miles Davis's seminal Almost Blue album. In addition, we'll also be airing three concerts in the Kimmel's organ recital series. I spoke with Kimmel Center Vice President for Programming and Education, Mervon Mehta, earlier this week, and first asked him how he keeps his programming fresh.
Every year we try to bring new people. I mean, if we don't risk and if we rest on our laurels, we hear about it from the public. And there are certain tried and true things that we can't not do, like the Chieftains. You know, it's every year it's become a tradition and they sell out and we make money, so why would you not do it? But then there are jazz artists and classical artists. When Christian Zimmerman, solo piano recital, first time in at the Kimmel Center. We know he's not going to sell out Verizon Hall, but it's an artist that is kind of at the top of his game, a consummate artist, not a celebrity, and deserves a chance to play in the big hall. And we will budget accordingly and, you know, hopefully have a nice turnout. But it's not going to be a turnout like Long Long. But it's an artist that we think we need to expose to the Philadelphia public. So we take a chance on him.
There was a time when Long Long wasn't a sellout either, and now he is.
Well, sure, yeah. He was not a sellout for the first 35 seconds of his career.
And now you have regulars who are coming back, and there was a certain brace of Curtis artists who came along as the Kimmel opened, who you showed loyalty to, who now have happened to turn into superstars, which was a nice turn of events. I'm thinking of Hillary and Long Long.
Hillary and Long Long, and there's a few more coming through. I mean, I'm a huge, huge fan of Yuja Wang. She's played with us already, not in a recital, but with the China Philharmonic Orchestra. Looking at her again for certain things. She's 20 or 21, I'm not sure. Not quite ready to play Verizon Hall. Not from a talent standpoint. She certainly is ready from talent, but we can't have her play in 2,500-seat hall and sell 600 tickets. It's not good for anybody. But we're looking at her closely and watching her career, and she will probably be the next one that we kind of try and elevate and make sure that, you know, we bring her for a recital, the orchestra brings her for something, PCMS does something with her, and because it's an incredible talent of this, you know, 98-pound little girl who's really catching the world by fire. I just got a call from the Israel Philharmonic because they had a cancellation. Then they heard about this girl from Philadelphia, and did I know her? I said, of course I know her. Book her tomorrow, and they did. And now she's playing and making her debut with the Israel Philharmonic in a couple of months.
Which brings us to the subject of the visiting orchestras. And I'm guessing the headline from all of this will be Gustavo Dudamel coming here with the Israel Philharmonic. Is the one that people are going to ask you about, I think, a lot in the next few days.
Well, I have to be careful because it's the Israel Philharmonic with Dudamel, who's now become a friend, so absolutely. But I also have a little conductor named Zubin Matos coming with the Vienna Philharmonic. No chump change there.
Many of his ex-orchestras are coming.
Yeah, actually, three of his orchestras are coming. He's never been music director of the Cleveland Symphony. So
not yet.
And at 72, I don't think he's looking. But between the Israel Philharmonic, the Vienna Philharmonic, only the second time in Philly in 50 years, the New York Phil making their final tour with Lauren Mazel, and the program he's bringing, I mean, actually all of the visiting orchestras that we're having are kind of playing music that's kind of in their wheelhouse. I mean, the Vienna Philharmonic playing Schubert C major. That's kind of what they were born to do. Tchaikovsky with the New York Philharmonic and Mazel. Bernstein with the Israel Philharmonic and Dudamel. And then the Cleveland Orchestra playing Shostakovich. So it's kind of, bringing the best orchestras that happen to be on tour, and they're bringing their best work to us, and we just have to sit and enjoy it.
Let's talk about some of the jazz content that you're going to be presenting. You're opening this year with, I know, a jazz program.
We've actually opened almost every season with a jazz program. Not really by any kind of magical design, but the jazz concert's on Friday nights, and we usually pick the first Friday before the Philadelphia Orchestra starts their series, so it happens, you know, we get that night. So we opened with Tony Bennett last two seasons ago and with the Count Basie Orchestra this year. But next year, 08-09, will be the return for the third time, but the 25th anniversary tour of Keith Jarrett, Jack DeJohnette, and Gary Peacock. They've just released two incredible records, actually two double CDs on ECM that really go back to the Great American Songbook. I mean, he's playing Ain't Misbehavin', and he's playing My Funny Valentine, which is not something we've heard lately from Keith Jarrett. Some of the stuff that he started out with. I've been listening to them, you know, a lot in the last 2 months or so since they came out. It's straight ahead playing through the first verse or two, and then he does his own Keith Jarrett improvisations on it. But he's comfortable and confident enough in the music that he can play it straight and then add his interpretation. Not like some that have to, from the first bar, you know, transpose everything and play it in minor seventh keys, and so it's unrecognizable. I think the audience is in for a huge kind of very, you know, I hate to say easy listening, but an easy listening experience of a master pianist, bass player, and I think probably the best jazz drummer since Max Roach.
Kimmel Center Vice President for Programming and Education, Mervon Mehta. The Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts season begins on Friday, September 19th, with a jazz concert featuring Keith Jarrett, Jack DeJohnette, and Gary Peacock. And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to Beth Yeagle, Brooke Honeyford, Daphne Demopoulos, and Gigi Lam. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.